Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frain, is at the controls this morning. In this part of the program, we'll talk a little bit about the power of natural disasters to alter the course of history. And as our case study, we will be talking about something that happened a long time ago, something like 3,600 years ago, when an immense volcanic eruption devastated the island of Thera in the southern Aegean. A lot of people think that maybe this eruption also led to the collapse of the area's major civilization of the time, the Minoans. They were centered on the island of Crete, not very far away, just 70 miles to the south. In this hour, we'll be talking with author, geologist Grant Hyken, a little bit perhaps about daily life in Thera in the Bronze Age, but also about what happened there those 3,600 years ago. He is here in Champaign-Urbana to talk about this very subject in a talk in the Millercom series. That will be tonight at 7:30, taking place in the Knight Auditorium of the Spurlock Museum. That's on South Gregory in Urbana. He'll also be giving a talk then tomorrow, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, about the relationship between history and geology in Rome, ancient Rome. And this is taking place in the Natural History Building in their lecture hall there. Both of these are open to the public, free, and anyone who is interested in attending should certainly feel welcome. And as we talk this morning, questions are welcome, too. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you have questions, you can call us. Grant Hyken is a geologist by his training. He's PhD in geology from University of California at Santa Barbara. He has worked as a geologist for NASA in their Planetary and Earth Sciences Division at the NASA Johnson Space Center in Houston. He's also worked in a number of capacities at the Los Alamos National Laboratory in the divisions of energy, geosciences, earth and space sciences, and earth and environmental science. And we're pleased to have him here with us in the studio. Glad to have you on the show.
I'm pleased to be here.
How did you, maybe this is not surprising, but as a geologist, how is it that you became interested in archaeology and in this connections between geology and life in the ancient world?
Well, geology's always been a very multidisciplinary field. And I don't know. I was just always interested in these sorts of things. I suppose today, if I had it to do all over again, I'd probably be a geographer, which is as or more multidisciplinary and is certainly a rising field. But I was working on energy programs at Los Alamos, and a very close friend who is an astrophysicist in Athens, and his family had a home on Thera, which to most people is known as Santorini. And we went over for a visit. I think it was 1976. And it was Sunday, and our wives were, trying out different Orthodox services. And after, we went and sat on the edge of the caldera and had coffee, and I started doing some back-of-the-envelope calculations of the size of the caldera. A caldera is a volcanic collapse crater, and essentially these craters form when there's a major eruption. These eruptions occur very quickly. They explosively erupt a lot of material over a very short period of time. And it's essentially evacuating the body of molten rock at depth, and it can't refill fast enough, so it collapses. But the general idea is that there's a close relationship between the volume of material erupted, which you can determine by mapping the deposits, and the volume of the collapsed crater itself. Well, there was a problem there. This thing, if what we knew about the volume at the time and the volume they were sitting there, on the edge of the caldera drinking coffee, just were off by at least a factor of two. And so I kind of got interested. I had a sabbatical coming up about 4 years later, and I got together with a friend of mine, Floyd McCoy, who was working at Woods Hole at that time on looking at these ash deposits across the eastern Mediterranean, we proposed that we do very detailed mapping of what the island looked like before this eruption, and then the, you know, looking at the deposits from the eruption to say, okay, why is there this difference? And we got some money from National Geographic and a little bit, I think, at the time from the National Science Foundation. I took my sabbatical. I think, also had a sabbatical, but a little later we overlapped a little bit. And we went from there, and the interesting discoveries at the time was, if you looked at the popular literature, it showed this eruption occurring on some giant Mount Fuji-type cone. It wasn't any such thing at all. The eruption occurred in a volcanic field which consisted of dozens of overlapping volcanoes along a trend that cut across which an island that was not volcanic before about 1.5 million years ago. And that the Bronze Age eruption, which occurred about 3,600 years ago and has been very well dated, actually formed in this volcanic field, which was bounded by an earlier collapse crater like this that was filled with water, and that was very important to the nature of the eruption. I'm probably getting away from myself here, but the interesting link is that this eruption occurred when Minoan civilization was cooking along. There's a tremendous amount of shipping, mercantile. They were mostly agriculture, but, you know, a very sophisticated civilization. They had a lot of disposable income. If you look at the frescoes of these people, they all were very well-groomed, well-dressed, jewelry. The town that was buried by the eruption, sometimes called as Akrotiria, sometimes called the Pompeii of the Aegean. And one of the little things, if you come to the talk tonight, that we'll talk about is, why weren't there any skeletons in this town? And I don't think I'll answer that question here. Maybe I'll get more people to come to the talk.
Fair enough.
And from there, actually, the other reason I went there was at the time we were doing a lot of work on geothermal development at the laboratory and essentially doing some work with the Greeks to evaluate the geothermal prospects on the island, which is part of most people don't know this, a volcanic chain that runs from the Peloponnese, just not too far from Athens, right down through Thera or Santorini and on over to the Turkish coast to some very, very young, still very hot volcanoes close to the Turkish coast. So I don't know. It just kind of went on from there. I keep asking people. I mean, we stay, you know, we did this work a long time ago, but we stay current, and my colleague Floyd McCoy is continuing to work on this subject, and a lot of geological work at other archaeological sites, particularly on Crete. And people keep asking us to talk about the damn thing. So here I am. But my real passion right now is trying to understand the relationship between cities and geology, and that's the subject of the talk on Friday afternoon at 4 o'clock, and basically, essentially, how the geologic setting controlled where Rome is and how it developed through time, and how today it's a sustainable city.
Well, just to talk a little bit more about Thera, or Santorini, it's now Santorini, it was in Thera. Obviously, this was a big event, and it made an impression on people, and people remembered it for a long time, and they talked about it for a long time. And and around this time, also, what happens is we see the fairly rapid decline of what had been this very advanced, dominant culture of the time, the Minoans. And so some people want to sort of draw a line, say, well, it blew away a big piece of Thera. It would have had very profound effects on the local environment. It was a major event. Was that, in fact, the thing that that in a sense tipped the balance, and there might have been other things going on. Maybe that wasn't the only thing. But was that really, that event really responsible for the decline of Minoan culture?
The answer is no. Strong winds in that part of the earth, and the two things that would have affected the Minoans of the time, who were seafaring peoples, was ashfall, which went mostly, well, to the east, southeast, and covered chunks of what's now Rhodes and the Turkish subcontinent on that side. It just barely clipped Crete. The thickest deposits on Crete are like maybe 4 centimeters. That's like 1.5 inches. And it certainly, and there were tsunamis. We didn't have much evidence for that, but there's been a lot of recent work, a lot of work this summer by the University of Rhode Island, doing oceanographic work around the island and in the crater itself to get the geophysical data that we need and the coring and sampling and so on to get a better handle on like volumes and what the nature of the deposits were. But also there's been work along the Turkish coast looking for tsunami deposits are very distinctive. You look in nearshore lagoons where it's mostly muds, and then suddenly there's this thick sand layer. And the only way for them to get there is rather catastrophically. And so they were calculating, and then they can model these things, and this group was calculating, I think, along the Turkish coast, a tsunami of anywhere from 2 to 6 meters, but the first island north of Thera, which is Ios, maybe up to 20 meters. There are some shoreline sites on Crete where it was evident that buildings were, the stone walls were knocked down and then brought back as the you know, sort of sagging on back out into the sea and leaving sandy deposits, sometimes topped off by a little ashfall or pumice fall. And but the archaeologists say basically that was in about 1620. BCE, or in the old terms, BC. Minoan civilization didn't really peak until about 100 years later. And then in the 15th century, the archaeologists would correct me, it collapsed, but apparently mainly from invasions, warfare, perhaps economic collapse, quote-unquote peoples from the north. And about that time, the Mycenaeans on the mainland, if you get up in the Peloponnese and places like that and go to Tiryns and ruins like that, they started picking up. And but the interesting thing about, you know, keeping track of this, both the tsunamis and the fallout, is that it's possible that if you look at these phenomena and how oral traditions of catastrophes developed going on through the Homeric sagas and on to Plato. It's about, you know, it's what, several, you know, 1,200 years or something like that. They and the, say, for example, the flooding legends of other cultures around the Eastern Mediterranean all come in about that time. Parting of the Red Sea was a lot later. Had nothing to do with the eruption, although there was some play in the newspapers probably 15 years ago about how there was a relationship between parting of the Red Sea and the eruption of Thera. No, they're off by a lot.
Yeah.
And so anyhow, excuse me,
yeah,
I'll have the other drink. A very resilient population, apparently. Very sophisticated civilization, and I'm sure they took a hit, but they kept on going.
Yeah. The thing that that I think is interesting, and I'm not sure how archaeologists think about this, but there is some speculation that the destruction of Thera, a very dramatic mm-hmm. event that people knew about
it.
People
on the island didn't make it.
They obviously they didn't come through. People around.
Well, maybe they did.
You'll have to attend the talk to find out. That the memory of that, of this big explosion, and of the probably unrelated decline of Minoan civilization. There are some people who think that those two things become blended together, and that is where the myth of Atlantis comes from.
Yeah, that's in thousands of publications.
And people at least say, well, that's an interesting idea.
Well,
maybe,
you know,
maybe so.
It could be. There are some people who interpret the myth of Atlantis as commentary on a social situation. Some people tie it to a catastrophic event. Some people, you know, really get out there and say it's out in the Atlantic somewhere or something like that. But if you Google Atlantis, you'll probably get 100,000 hits. And of those 100,000, there might be 2,000 that are scholarly, and the rest of them are weekly world news type stuff. And but, you know, it's one of the, I think it's just fascinating that these, and there are examples elsewhere in the world of how oral traditions are carried on from catastrophic events. And then until there was the written word, they just went from generation to generation to generation. And, you know, they get twisted, exaggerated a little bit, but they're there.
Mm-hmm.
And those oral traditions were carried on until the time of when Atlantis was written about and put down. But, you know, it depends. I'm not a classicist. I read a lot of classics, but, you know, there's an interesting, I haven't had one in a while, but there's a Greek ship owner, Peter Nomikos, whose family is from that island. And he's fascinated by the topic of what happened in the Aegean at that time, and he's created an institute in London. And he used to have these meetings called Theory in the Aegean World, where I think the last one was like 89, where he'd bring together volcanologists, geologists, classicists, art historians, CEOs of Greek extraction, and have these really incredible week-long meetings where people would hammer it out. I know until people started using carbon-14 dating and so on, there was a lot of argument of when this eruption occurred. At the time, maybe 20, 30 years ago, the archaeologists and the classicists said, well, it's about 1450 BCE, based on the vase painting, the styles. And I remember walking down the street with one of them in today's Fira town, looking in a souvenir shop, and they said, there's one there. Was it painted in 1450? And he kind of hemmed and hawed. But most of those people have completely yielded to modern dating techniques and measurements of acid layers and ice cores and growth rings and Irish bog oaks and things like that. So it's pretty well accepted. I don't think anyone is still hanging on to the dating of the eruption based on art as such.
Mm-hmm.
So where were we?
Well, that puts it at that
about 1626 BCE.
Okay.
Before Common Era, if you're modern, BC, before Christ, if you know. Yeah. A few years.
I mean, old guys like us.
Old guys like us keep saying AD and BC.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Let me reintroduce our guest.
You don't look that old.
Well, we can talk about that later. I don't remember BC from, like, personal experience, but, you know, when I was a kid, we were still using that. Grant Hyken is a geologist. He has worked for NASA, for the Los Alamos National Laboratory. He is here to give a couple of talks. He'll be giving a talk about this subject here that we've been talking about the eruption of the volcano on Thera, now the island known as Santorini, and what that was all about and what might have been the result. This is a talk in the MillerCom series, and that's tonight on the U of I campus, 7:30, in the Knight Auditorium of the Spurlock Museum. Then he'll be talking about some more recent kind of work and a more recent kind of interest, and that is about history and geology in Rome. And that talk is 4 o'clock tomorrow afternoon in the Lecture Hall of the Natural History Building. All of these things, both of these things, are open to anybody who would like to attend. And all you have to do is pick up the telephone and give us a call, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. There is there on Santorini. There's again, I don't want to force you to give away too much of the talk through Jim, but there are things there. If you go there today, you can see what remains of the folks and how they lived there. It's kind of I think the comparison is that it's like you can now today go to Pompeii and you can see right. what has been excavated. There are similar kinds of things to be seen on Santorini.
There is. It's the village of Akrotiri, and you can't miss it when you Google Santorini for the tourist attractions. But I'm not sure if it's open yet. Last year, the site is covered with roofs. And last year, one of these roofs collapsed and killed a tourist. And, you know, in good legalistic thing, instead of investigating it, fixing it, and going on, they've closed the site. But I hope it's open by now. I didn't check. Mm-hmm. But if you go, be sure and allow yourself lots of time. Most of the tours will just run you in and out at about 35 or 40 minutes, and it's too big a site for that. And there's a lot to see. There is a nice little museum in Fira town, which is the main town. The National Museum in Athens has a lot of very important things, including the frescoes that were preserved by this eruption. And it's these frescoes that give us a lot of clues of what life was like, kind of postcards of Minoan life on the island before the eruption. So those three things, the National Museum, when you go through Athens, spend time in Akrotiri. There's a little museum in the town. I don't know what the hours are. And bring your swimsuit. It's a beautiful spot.
So this was an outpost. I don't know if it's not all that far away from Crete, so maybe outpost is the wrong word to use, but this was, in fact, an outpost of Minoan culture.
Maybe, and it could have just been a way station, essentially, between mainland and Crete. It's about halfway mm-hmm. between. And all the other islands. I mean, there are many, many islands in the Aegean. And they were all connected. They had galleys, and big galleys and small galleys, and they're very much seafarers. And I said, and it was evident that they did a lot of trade. And let's see. And if you go to Crete, then that's a good solid week of looking at Minoan reconstructions and excavations and so on, which have, you know, they've been excavating down there since the mid to late 1800s, mm-hmm. and by some very strong and like Evans and people like that. Schliemann in the north for the Mycenaeans. Evans on Crete, who did some incredible work considering the time, but also came up with some pretty wild speculations. Mm-hmm. But at that time, they didn't have things like carbon-14 dating and so on.
When you, as a geologist and volcanologist, someone who's particularly interested in studying volcanoes and how they work, when you have an opportunity to look at a place like Santorini, is when you look at it and you study it, is what you learn of purely of a geological significance? I guess I'm still interested in, you know, hooking it to
right, no,
archaeology.
Not at all. I mean, although people intellectually seem to be almost universally intrigued by this, the island itself is, you know, normally, well, when I first went there, it was less than 2,000 people on the island. And you landed in a funny little Russian plane that held about 12 people, or you took the ferry. Now they're looking at any one time in midsummer, there are 30,000 tourists on the island, on this very small island, which is about 9.5 kilometers long. It's crazy. Don't go in the summer. Since the Minoan eruption, there's a line of volcanoes that cut across the collapsed, flooded crater, the caldera, which have been erupting off and on since Imperial Roman times. The last eruption there was in 1950. It's still hot. I mean, there are hot springs all over the place at depth underwater. And then off about 6 miles northeast of the island is a submarine volcano, a big one. The rim is fairly shallow depth. The crater's about 500 and some odd meters deep. And it erupted in 1650 rather catastrophically, and the gases and the tsunamis killed quite a few people on the island itself. It certainly gassed all the livestock on that end of the island. So the Greeks, the Greek volcanologists are spending a lot of time monitoring. But the big question is, if you have an impending eruption in the wintertime, probably not a big deal. You can get people off the island. Because there's the airport, which is downwind, if there's ash, so you don't land. And the ferry dock is in the crater, in the flooded crater. So how do you get people off? And if it happens in the summer, how do you get, what did I say, something like 30,000 gormless tourists off the island? I mean, it's just, it's an incredible challenge. And it's one of education, not only of the local people and the tour operators and so on, but how do you get to the people who are just coming down there to get sun and
maybe look around the ruins a little bit.
Look around the ruins and Greek food and and party time.
You know? Well, when you look at this, what this looks like from the air, you could see that what happened was a natural kind of harbor was formed. So that you would naturally think, okay, if you're going to put a port in, well, obviously that's where you put it. At the same time, though, knowing that, at some point, did someone say, well, maybe that's not the best, actually, idea to put the port there, or maybe we should have one on the other side of the island?
That takes money.
Oh, well. Well, then.
And I don't know what they've done lately. Maybe this recent work by the people at the University of Rhode Island will prod them a bit, because what they found is not encouraging. What they found out about what they have found out so far about the submarine volcano to the north is kind of scary in a way. And of course, if that erupts, then they can get people out from the flooded crater itself. That wouldn't be a problem. But in either case, what is now an international jet port would just simply close down, because you don't fly planes in volcanic ash.
Yeah, you don't want to get your jet engines to get all clogged up with ash, because then
they don't necessarily get clogged up. The operating temperatures are higher than the melting point of the ash, and it coats the fuel injectors with glass.
Oh.
So then it shuts down.
Then it shuts down. Okay. Well, yeah, you don't want to do that.
Sorry, we're getting off the topic here.
Oh, that's okay. This may be almost too much of a question to ask, but how well are we doing now in understanding what makes volcanoes happen, and how is our ability to predict when an eruption might occur?
Our ability to forecast an eruption is very good if there are instruments, geophysical instruments, on the volcano and around the volcano. And the problem is that probably, 5% of the world's potentially active volcanoes are monitored, just because, it takes money, people, time. What is possible is, say, for example, taking the situation in Indonesia, where they have many, 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 many potentially active volcanoes on the chain of islands that makes up Indonesia. They're very clever. They have a really wonderful staff of volcanologists in Bandung. And they'll go out to a village near one of these volcanoes, say, who's your best high school student? Take them to Bandung, send them to trade school for a while to learn electronics and whatnot. Give them an intensive course in what to look for. And they run their own little observatory, very cost-effective. And they know what to look for in precursor symptoms. They have a simple seismic event counter, things like that. And as things start to pick up, they phone Bandung and they send out a crew. And so far it's worked really well. I mean, that way you don't have to have, 1,000 PhDs sitting in these small villages. And the other component is education. And they use these little observatories to educate the people in the town as to what's going on. And they're highly respected in the town. They're not just some foreign stranger who comes in to save them. Basically, the State Department, Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance, they provide money to the U.S. Geological Survey for a rapid response team for volcanoes. And so if there's an area where they don't have that covered, they fly out with all their tools and they start working. So, you know, if you've got the instruments, forecasting is good. If you don't have the instruments, it's not good.
Yeah. Well, you can understand that in a place like Indonesia, where it's one of the most active for volcanoes on the face of the earth, that they would be concerned enough about it to set up essentially an early warning system like that. I'm sure there are probably a lot of other places where there has in the past been activity where it's just been asleep for a long time, and maybe they just don't. They think about the possibility there could be an eruption, but it sounds like they're really not. You know, it's been 1,000 years or 500 years or something, and that's really they got other things to think about.
Yeah, it's like was it 91, the eruption of Pinatubo in the Philippines. The Philippines have a wonderful institute for volcanologists. They too have a lot of volcanoes, and Pinatubo hadn't erupted in 600 years. And then it started having these precursor phenomena, steam blasts and so on, where the geothermal system kind of goes wild because the temperatures are going up. And they brought in people from the U.S. and their own team, and they went out and quickly looked at what were the deposits there, and they found these density currents called pyroclastic flows, only 600 years old, all around the volcano. And then they started lecturing and educating the people who lived in the region and the people at Clark Air Force Base, the commander there and the commander at Subic, the naval base nearby. Took a bit of convincing, but when they first started getting activity, instead of questioning what was going on, all these people had been educated with TV videos and so on as to what the phenomena were and what to look for. And 50,000 people evacuated, and most of them survived. And it was a matter of quick response, education, education. Mm-hmm. So many people, they think of a volcanic eruption, they think of a lava flow, like in Hawaii, where, we can walk out in front of that. They don't realize that most of these explosive volcanoes, you're getting density currents of very hot ash and hot gases moving at hurricane velocities. You don't get away.
Yeah.
And the other big problem is ash fall, in that if you don't keep your roof clean, it collapses. And that's been evident over and over and over again. Going back to, say, Pompeii, where a lot of the problems there were roofs collapsing, or maybe there's some people that say people were suffocated by CO2, which is possible, before they were buried.
We are a bit past the midpoint here. In fact, we're into about our last 15 minutes, and I would like to introduce once again our guest for this part of Focus 580, Grant Hyken. He is an independent consultant, an author, geologist. He has a PhD in geology from University of California, Santa Barbara. Worked as a geologist for the NASA Johnson Space Center in Houston and their Planetary and Earth Sciences Division. Also worked at the Los Alamos National Laboratory in several divisions, energy, geosciences, Earth and Space Sciences, Earth and Environmental Sciences. And he will be giving a couple of talks here on the U of I campus while he is here, talking tonight about the eruption of Thera. And we talked a little bit about that. It happened, I guess in round figures, about 3,600 years ago. What that was all about and what it might have meant for the people who were living there at the time. This is tonight, 7:30, in the Knight Auditorium of the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory in Urbana. That's open to anybody who would like to attend. It's a MillerCom event. Also, he'll be giving a talk about history and geology and how those two things are connected in ancient Rome. And that's tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock in the lecture hall at the Natural History Building. And there again, anyone who would like to attend is welcome. Also, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Maybe you would like to talk a little bit about history and geology in Rome. Is it connected to the extent that you would say that Rome is where it is because of the geology?
Oh, absolutely. I was involved, oh gosh, we started this maybe 11, 12 years ago in organizing a group of scientists and engineers and so on, trying to get, you know, essentially doing integrated urban science, which involves a lot of geology and so on. And I was looking for places where I could, so we started working on this in Los Angeles and Dallas and things like that. But about halfway through this project, I started thinking, well, you know, I got to go experience where they're actually using geology, ecology, hydrology, and so on within a large working city. I had colleagues, Renato Funicello and Donatello Derita in Rome, University of Rome III, who were leaders in at what at the time was a huge monograph called The Geology of Rome, Geology di Roma, which showed all these interactive things. And I got so excited about it. So we got to get that into a book, a general interest book, so people can see these relationships. So I went and spent 6 months, thanks to the Fulbright Foundation, working with them, and we produced this popular book called The Seven Hills of Rome. How's that for a plug?
No problem.
And basically what we did there is, it's not just ancient Rome, but Rome through time up to today and kind of forecasting into the future for the sustainability of the city and how important the location was, not only for defense, building materials, water supplies, but also how the city has been affected by the geologic setting of structures, you know, during earthquakes and so on like that. So it gets a lot more complex than that. But we're continuing to roll on that and trying to encourage other cities to do the same thing. Right now, the only other place where this is really happening in any big way is in the greater Phoenix metropolitan area. Hong Kong, that's about it. And a little bit of activity in Seattle. But what we were trying to get at is how important it is for each city to have as employees their own sort of integrated science team to work with all the other parts of the city, everything from, you know, the social aspects to the infrastructure, natural hazards, the whole thing like that. And found that in this early work that we did at Los Alamos that they could use these tools once you had some idea of how a city functioned in a scientific manner, that you could use these tools for planning or sustainability, national security sort of issues. The tools are all the same. It's just understanding what's there and basically taking a look at this rampant uncontrolled growth around most large cities. And people just aren't doing it. If you look at some cities aren't like this, and I'll probably get called on this, but most cities are broken down into compartments, and they don't talk to each other. And we found both in the modeling and in what's going on in Rome that by talking to each other, they can do some really cost-effective things to make the city a better place. I know this is very strongly supported by the mayor of Rome and his staff, Walter Veltroni, who most recently was, you know, on a lot of websites for starting the Rome Film Festival, but he's really into sustainability issues. And if you wander around Rome, you realize a lot of it's green and always has been. Part of that green is because of all these ruins and so on, but part of it is they just have a lot of parks and places, you know, where you can enjoy the city.
Yeah. We have a caller here I want to bring in the conversation. Just in case you're interested, by the way, that is The Seven Hills of Rome, A Geological Tour of the Eternal City, published by the Princeton University Press.
Oh, thank you.
Came out last summer, right? Last July. Okay.
And if they want to wait, the paperback's out in April.
Okay. And if you would like to talk with us, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Urbana for us to talk with. Line one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
We visited Thera from Crete, arriving in August, which I really recommend against because it seems like all of Europe is on Thera and everywhere else because they're all on vacation. And when you get to an island, if you can't find a place to stay, it's kind of tough, you know. but we arrived about, I think you can fly in maybe, but we took a ferry from Crete, and I kept looking for this volcano, and I realized finally that we were in it. I had seen volcanic mountains in the North Pacific Northwest from distances, but I really didn't have a sense of how big this was going to be, and it was really interesting to realize the ferry just sailed right into the caldera, because I hadn't seen complete pictures of it. I hadn't understood what was going on, and it really is interesting. You can see layers and layers of ash for people who haven't seen pictures of that aspect of it. It seems like a lot of pictures of Greek islands are taken on Thera with the white buildings and looking down into the sea, and it's. I wish we would have been able to stay in one of the in the hotel that's run by the Greek government. That's on the north end of the island, and it's the traditional rooms built into the ash. So anyway, I just wanted to recommend. It really is a lovely place to be, and it's nice if you can go when you're not being shuffled around with lots and lots of other people and having difficulty moving around the island. But it is nice. So nice to hear what you're talking about. Thanks.
Well, I recommend that you go in the spring. Easter's great. It's cool. The water's a bit cool, but if you don't mind that, it's beautiful. There aren't so many people. The Easter celebrations are very, very special. And the local people will, just allow you to participate. So it's spring or fall. Winter can get pretty nasty. Summer, forget it.
All right. And other questions are certainly welcome here in the time we have left, about 5 minutes or so. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Perhaps I don't know if there's enough time for you to go back to this, to some of the things that you were talking about in connection with the study that you did of Rome and this whole, you know, how it is that you connect geology with urban planning, and how some consideration of geological realities maybe also dictate how, you know, what kind of a city that you have, how you design it, what life in there is like.
Let me just give you an example.
Yeah.
The Seven Hills of Rome are actually dissected parts of a plateau of these volcanic ash deposits that came from the Alban Hills, which form these massive deposits. And the Seven Hills are actually sort of fingers of a plateau that stick out. But those Seven Hills, they're right on the Tiber. Rome was very much a seafaring civilization. So ships would come in from all over the Mediterranean world and as far away as what's Britain today, and dock down in an artificial harbor down near what is now the International Airport, Leonardo da Vinci. And then they would offload to barges which came up the Tiber, so you were right there on the water. The plateaus also supplied most of the basic building stone for the city, these consolidated volcanic ash deposits. The Romans realized that if you had an open quarry, you're losing land. So all of these quarries are underground. And much of the building stone, say if you go through the Roman Forum, look at the base below the marble facings and so on, and some of the marble columns, and you'll find that most of this material came from... So if you were to strip off, say, the top 20 or 30 meters of Rome, you would find something that would look like an anthill under a rock if you turn the rock over. It's just honeycombed with these things. They can be used. Some people grow mushrooms in them, and they don't really know where they all are, and occasionally when they're building a new building, the thing collapses into one of these quarries. So the Romans themselves, you know, they did this because they were trying to save land. They also, the way they built some of their facilities and so on, they pretty much avoided the Tiber floodplain until, say, 1920, 1930, when they started building dams on the Tiber watershed. They had terrible floods, which would flood that whole lower area, which was mostly... The Roman facilities down there were like playing fields, and they actually had something like the Colosseum, only it was for nautical battles. They would flood it. But the campus of Mars, the fields of Mars, were basically for military training, things like that. If they got flooded, well, you clean them up. But in medieval times, it was very heavily developed. If you go, say, for example... I'm drifting here. Sorry. If you, for example, go to the great concrete structure the Romans built. I just blanked out on it. Down on the plains, there's some of these older buildings. You see plaques on the sides of the buildings. So some of these plaques are like 15 feet above the ground. These are high flood levels.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, floods, they clean it up. In the Piazza Navona, for example, in the 1870s, they had floods. They got out boats and made, you know, a day on the punting, you know, essentially. Other relationships, the early Romans discovered that they had just incredible natural springs in the Apennines, and they brought them down on by aqueducts to the city, and it required a lot of very careful surveying and engineering. If you go back, the Romans had surveying instruments, much like what we have today. They didn't have telescopes, but they had to measure these slopes very carefully, but bring the water into the city. And not only, you know, many of the aqueducts are built of these same volcanic ash materials and concrete. They were big into concrete, but it was a special concrete made with volcanic ash. I can go on and on about these things. But even today, Rome, if you walk around Rome, there are these little fountains all over the place where you can, you know, lean your head down and get a drink of water, something like that. That's not treated water. They have perfectly clean water, and it's almost endless. The only possible thing that they have to worry about, and they are worrying about, is that the headwaters where these springs are located in the Apennines, there's a lot of new development, summer homes, ski areas, and so on. So they have to be very careful about how they deal with sewage and things like that. But for the moment, it's about the only major city in the world where they don't have to worry about their water supply, and that's been true since Imperial Roman time.
I have a caller here trying to get in when we still have some time. Someone calling from Champaign. Let's do that. Line one.
Good morning.
Yes.
This is just wonderful. It's just fascinating. My question is not, though, about Greece or Rome. My question is about central France. And I have, I'm wondering about the Massif Central, where there are a number of extinct volcanoes, and are they really extinct, or is there any possibility that those volcanoes could ever become active again?
Well, it's one of these situations where they are extinct, but they are very young. And the French, you know, they're in Clermont-Ferrand at the university. They have a bunch of volcanologists who worry about things like that. But what the French worry about mostly in volcanoes are their islands like Martinique and Guadeloupe and Réunion, where they do have active volcanoes. But no, they've very carefully mapped them, studied the deposits that provide the history and the frequency of eruptions and things like that for the Massif Central. But for the moment, it's a nice place to visit, nice place to walk. Good cheese.
So you're not worried that you're not where you could be strolling along and a volcano will erupt.
No, not for the moment. Of course, they said the same thing about Pinatubo, but they, most of their effort goes into their islands where they have active. Matter of fact, eruptions going on right now in Réunion.
We are going to have to stop because we've come here to the end of the time for this morning. But if you would like to hear more from our guest, Grant Hyken, and you are here in and around Champaign-Urbana, you have two opportunities. He will be speaking in a MillerCom talk about the Bronze Age volcanic eruption of Thera. And that's tonight at 7:30 in the Knight Auditorium of the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory in Urbana. And then talking about history and geology in ancient Rome. Well, I guess not just in ancient Rome, but in Rome from the ancient times to the present. And that's 4 o'clock tomorrow afternoon at the Natural History Building in their lecture hall. And if that's something that interests you, you can look for this book that we have mentioned, The Seven Hills of Rome, A Geological Tour of the Eternal City. Published by the Princeton University Press. It came out last summer, and then the spring it's going to be out in paperback, so if you want to wait for that.
In paperback and in Italian if you want that.
So. Oh, all right, and in Italian if you want that. Our guest, Grant Hyken, is an independent consultant, author, geologist, worked for NASA, and also worked for the Los Alamos National Lab in New Mexico. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.